Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Yes, it's episode 23 of the Northern Football Podcast on a Friday. Yes, because special days call for special editions of the show. This is the first time we're recording twice in a week, but for good reason. I'm Peter Galindo. He's Thomas Neff. We are both a little sleep deprived, and we have Canadian soccer to blame for that. How are you doing, sir? I hope you have a pitcher of iced coffee next to you like I do right now.
I do. I had two coffees, but hey, I mean, that's the life that, you know, we chose to live. I think we chose this, but yeah, I mean, bittersweet. The men going out in the semifinals, the women winning in the quarters, going to the semis and playing potentially a bronze medal match, perhaps a final as well.
Possibly. We shall find out, of course. Before we dive into what is a jam-packed episode, we are very pleased to announce that we're partnering with Northern Tribune. If you haven't already, and why haven't you, give them a follow at North Tribune. They do incredible work in the Canadian game, which is why this makes sense for us to partner together. We'll be posting the podcast on there with a detailed rundown of the show after every episode, so give those a look when you have the chance. And a reminder to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and to leave a rating and review for us on Apple Podcasts if that is your platform of choice, because that helps the show a lot. All right, where do we start with this? Mexico 2, Canada 1. Canada's Gold Cup coming to an end after a gut-wrenching loss, to say the least, after Hector Herrera's 99th minute goal, yes, in the 9th minute of stoppage time. That followed Tejon Buchanan's amazing equalizer in the 57th minute after I pointed out his decision-making in the box still needed work. You are welcome for that, Canada. Orbelin Pineda opened the scoring late in the first half via a penalty conceded by Daniil Henry, which was awarded by VAR. Following a quick brawl, the first of many on the night, this match really had everything. You had scuffles, VAR, controversial refereeing, which is always a CONCACAF classic when Mexico's involved, late winners, comebacks, back and forths. I really struggled to write this rundown thanks to this game specifically. So, Thomas, let's maybe try to keep this as chronological as possible. In that first half, which was eventful in its own right, what did you make of how it transpired?
Oh, boy. Well, first, let's talk about the penalty kick, okay?
Sure.
Daniil Henry doing Daniil Henry things. Listen, we've been here before. He's made these mistakes. I'm not a stats guy. I know you are.
Yes.
I tweeted this out. I know you're a stats guy. I'm not. But this has to be, what, the fourth or the fifth time that Daniil has, you know, challenged like that in the box and given the opposition a penalty kick that's ended up in their own back net? I mean, I would have thought that he learned his lesson. You know, it's very frustrating. And it's not like he did it on purpose. Obviously not, never. But, you know, I was starting to feel good about Daniil. I was trying to trust Henry, you know, just because he showed a lot more calmness, especially playing in back three, and especially playing with Johnson and Miller, which was helped him a lot. And I thought he was a new player. Not a new player, but a resurgence of him. But yeah, just, you know, he has to do better. You can't challenge like that in the box, especially when you have 72,000 fans cheering for Mexico and you have the ref. If I speak, I'm in trouble. You have the ref in front of you. I'm sorry, but that was a penalty kick. I did say that earlier. I think that was the right call. I think this was on Daniil Henry. And look, Mexico going early, never a right situation. But overall, Peter, if we're going to talk about the first half overall, obviously the stats speak for themselves. We had zero shots on goal. So it was, for me, it was really the second half that Canada really turned things up.
It is, and that's why you probably say that Mexico probably just narrowly deserved the lead. Like, Canada did defend fairly resolutely, but then you could see that as the half was going on, really right before the penalty was awarded, and I guess when it happened, because it happened a couple minutes before VAR eventually gave it to them. By the way, how did Chaka Rodriguez not get sent off for putting his hand on the throat of Mark Anthony Kay? Like, I guess the argument could be, oh, he was trying to hold him back and make sure he didn't fight anybody, but by the letter of the law, that's a red card, and you have to imagine if the shoe was on the other foot, or I guess if the hand was on the other throat in this case, then a Canadian player probably would have gotten sent off for that. But listen, this is CONCACAF. It's going to happen. You can't get too frustrated with it. You just have to accept it. But the way that the first half really was panning out, Canada defending in a 5-4-1 or 5-3-2 at times, depending on the situation, was working decently well. But I think the way that Pineda, Herrera, and Gallardo were containing Eustaquio, really one of the outlets for that right-hand side, it made it difficult to release Tejon Buchanan into space when he was playing as deep as he was. And Kay was also being nullified, which kind of limited the left side a little bit, but really you have to credit Hoylett and Lai for combining down the left in the first half when they did, and obviously Lai getting a pretty good chance around, what was it, the 25th, 26th minute, and kind of wasted it in my opinion. But, you know, had he made a faster decision in the box, had Jonathan Osorio been a little bit more of a quick thinker when he had an opportunity 5 minutes later, like Buchanan did later on in the game, they might have created a good chance out of it. But then on the flip side too, I feel like the few times that Tecatito and Herrera and Pineda were drifting into the pockets of space between midfield and defense, they cause a lot of problems. Funes Mori was sucking out Henry, which opened up space centrally. One of those guys would run into the box, and they would usually get a decent look at goal. But most of the time, too, Kamal Miller and Alistair Johnston were there to make the vital intervention, or Crepeau was there to make the save. But then on top of that, too, I felt like Johnston was struggling mightily in the air in the first half, whether it was crosses to the back post or just simple balls over the top. And at times, he couldn't really cope with those Gallardo overlaps, because you could see that, you know, Pineda and Herrera, whoever it happened to be on that side, were kind of waiting for Gallardo to make the run deep towards the byline and then lay it off to Gallardo to cross it in. And Johnston just couldn't really cope with it, understandably, because he was going up against two guys at once. But that's why I felt like Mexico maybe just edged the first half. I don't know how you would see it.
No, I see it the same way. Look, Canada had two or three quality chances, but they were all on the counterattack.
Right.
Like, they were all on the counterattack. It wasn't, you know, a chance that we created of our own. It was more of a defensive mistake made by Mexico. And I don't know about you, Peter, but that was Eustaquio shot. I mean, I thought for a second, just because I trust so much in the player, I thought for a second it could have gone in. But, no, I mean, I think Crepeau saved us a handful of times in the first half. And Mexico were attacking mostly by the flanks. If you could see, Canada was applying a lot of pressure through the middle. And that's what I loved about Canada, that they were pressing. Because I feel like a few games ago, even in the June World Cup qualifying window, they were pressing and it worked for them, and they sort of got away from that. And they gave teams more of a chance to attack through the middle. And then if you could see in the first half, Mexico was attacking through the flanks the entire time. Mm-hmm. The entire time. So, and I think that helped Canada because, both you and I were in the press conference, not only with John Herdman, but Tata Martino.
Yeah.
And one of the things he said was the speed of the players. And I think that's where Canada strives as much, maybe the physical aspect, technical, but I think the speed, because, you know, for the most part, Canada had them covered every time that Mexico decided to go down the flank. There was a couple of times where it caused some trouble, but then you had Max Crepeau to bail you out.
You did, and that's absolutely true, because it's almost funny how that game played out from Mexico's side, because they were doing well to kind of contain Canada's midfield, but then were focusing everything on the flanks, and that's understandable, because they have offensive-minded fullbacks. Why not use them? But then the second half, that's when everything really changed. And this isn't the first time either that Canada's kind of come out in second halves and really taken it to the opposition, whether it's Haiti or Suriname or, in this case now, Mexico. And really, I think it coincided with Buchanan getting further forward, them switching to a 4-4-2, him playing on his inverted side on the left, and then he scores off some wonderful buildup from Miller and Kay. I mean, that response was a little bit unexpected, because you figured, okay, they're down a goal, they're missing all these key attackers. Are they going to be able to get themselves back into the game? And they did. I was personally pleasantly surprised that they did, and the response was clearly positive.
Yeah, I mean, look, the formation change, it looked like 4-4-2 at times, yeah. And then sometimes it looked like a 3-5-2. I don't know. I didn't know what to make. At first, I thought, okay, Lahi as a left back playing out of position, how will he do? He looked fine. He looked good. And Osorio playing as a center forward. I mean, I thought for a second, I'm like, what's going on? He's mostly used as playing as a central attacking midfielder, but they looked okay. They looked okay. I have to make this point again, and I'm sorry to sound like a broken record, but it's so frustrating. It's so frustrating that this match wasn't on television in Canada, because yes, Canada received good exposure in the U.S., Fox Sports, TUDN, in Mexico was broadcasting on Azteca, yep. and all over Central America, and maybe in South America and parts of Europe too, mm-hmm. but you know, Aaron, we have to be the only country. I swear to God, we have to be the only country where it's not. And it was such a good game. Like, I'll have to go more into detail after, but this was the best match that I've ever seen from Canada in the Herdman era. We looked literally like a World Cup team. And I know we looked like a World Cup team against Costa Rica, mm-hmm. but that Costa Rica was missing many, many players, like way more than Mexico.
Yes.
And they had a new coach, and the coach didn't pick the 23-man roster. It was the Federation that picked it.
Yes.
And they didn't have 70,000 fans cheering for them, right?
Also true.
So they have all those conditions, and look, I have to say, you know, things started off a bit shaky in the first two games, but in the U.S., Costa Rica, now Mexico, now the players are really prepared for September, for the Ocho. Like, this is the real task, and I honestly thought, Peter, like I said this in the preview, and I want to say that I actually thought that the score would be somewhat close, 3-1, 2-1, 2-0, that's what I said.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I forgot to say was, I thought Canada was going to maybe stay in it for 50, 60 minutes, and we stayed in it for 98 minutes. So
yeah,
for me, it's more positive than negative.
It is. And what was even more notable was you mentioned that Martino talked about how Canada's speed was putting them under pressure. You noticed that to start the second half, Mexico was playing a very high line, and slightly surprising. I guess they kind of wanted to go for the jugular and thought, all right, we've scored. They're probably not going to want to expose themselves too much. So let's kind of go for that second goal and see what we can do. But that's where the speed really hurt them, because then Buchanan, obviously after some wonderful play from Miller and Kay, gets in behind that high line. Salcedo, who had a poor game defensively for Mexico, by the way, just could not contain him. He gets a quick shot off and scores. That's why they ended up kind of retreating after that, and why they were quote-unquote parking the bus, because they realized, okay, these guys can burn us for speed. Let's not give them the space to run into. Let's keep them in front of us. And given that Canada most of the time has struggled to break down deeper blocks, that's not a terrible strategy to use. You know, it is quite notable that Mexico was like, all right, let's stand down and not get hurt by Canada. Because when is the last time you have ever heard that?
You know, it really was, Peter. And I have to say, at times you could say that Canada was playing to their full potential. And you ask yourself what it could have been if we had Davies, David, Laren available.
Of course.
Or even Cavallini. This is the game that suits Lucas Cavallini, right?
Yep.
I mean, we have to be proud of this performance. There are some things for sure. Like, there's never perfect games, and I know you and I always focus on the good and the not so good, but that's because that's our job, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what I liked from this match is that yes, tensions were running high. Yes, the refereeing was going against you. Yes, you had fans. But look, I mean, this is what it's going to be like in September and October and November and March. So, you know, it prepares Canada perfectly. And Canada hadn't been tested like this ever.
No.
Like, I think even against that U.S. game that Canada won in October of 2019, you could say, okay, yeah, that's the glimpse of this potential of this team. And it was, and it is. But even then, there was 10,000 fans in the crowd. Mm-hmm. That U.S. team was still very much in the midst of a generational change.
Yes.
Like it was, McKenny wasn't where he was at. Tyler Adams wasn't where he was at. Pulisic was, you know, on the bench. So there was still changes to be made. This Mexico team, besides a couple of players like Ochoa, Guardado, Olzano, this is pretty much like a full-strength Mexico team. Yeah. You know, in terms of that, and look, before we get into specifics, you mentioned it there, and I know Tayshaun Buchanan, that was an incredible goal. I think that's the icing on the cake as far as securing a move to Europe, potentially the Bundesliga. And Herdman said it. He deserves to be either in the Bundesliga or the Premier League.
Moving him into that higher position and shifting into a more defined 4-4-2, 4-1-3-2 defensively, it helped. It really helped. And they couldn't handle him on the flanks. He just ran out of gas. I mean, bless him, he ran out of gas. If, you know, give him another year and get him into hopefully the Bundesliga or into the Premier League, because that's where this kid's destined. You know, he'll build that quality. He'll build that durability at the top level.
No, yeah, very good point. And given that New England turned down $3.5 million from Lens like a couple weeks ago, that kind of brings to question, all right, how much money could they actually get now after the Gold Cup? Because this was in the midst of the tournament. And given what he has shown against some of the best teams in the region, you have to imagine he's probably going to end up garnering a lot more money for the club over the next month or so here as the transfer window continues. You do make great points, though, and all the credit in the world for Canada for not backing down and adjusting yet again while trailing, because it's one thing to go in there and hold Mexico. It's another thing then to come back against them and really make them sweat. And I think it was notable too. Yes, okay, you don't want your players getting into those kind of fights every single game, but it also shows that they're not backing down. And you could see that some of Mexico's players were a little bit stunned that the Canadians were so feisty with them, that they were almost like, whoa, okay, calm down. Like, I did not expect you to react like this. And that's what you want to see. You want to see the players, for lack of a better term, giving a you-know-what, right? You want to see them not just fighting for every ball and every 50-50 and really giving it their all for each other, but you also want to see them fight back. So from that aspect, they continue to show this. And this is why I feel like a lot of people, which we'll get into, have asked us about, you know, what does this mean for the future? But before we do, in the second half, another penalty was called. It was on Marc-Anthony Kay for what looked like a harmless foul that, by the letter of the law, is a foul anywhere else on the pitch. But again, if the shoe was on the other foot, like let's say Hector Moreno fouls Tayshaun Buchanan in that situation, does VAR even check it? Probably not. But Maxime Crepeau, in a ball don't lie moment, ended up saving Carlos Salcedo's penalty, which prompted like 18 million questions from the Mexican press after the game for Martino, but I digress. Do you think, based on not just this game, but the entire tournament, that Maxime Crepeau should be the starting goalkeeper for Canada going forward, as asked by Naujmart at Tito_Catrach?
Yeah, great question. I said this at the start of the tournament. I said this in the preview, and you can even check it out after. I said that this would be a great opportunity for Max Crepeau to get experience, to get ready for September. You know, maybe of the three, if every single window, which has three games, give Max Crepeau maybe a game, the least important, or the one that you don't expect to win, like the strategy-wise. And I said that in an honest way, and I thought, yes, he has now 11 caps for Canada, and he's built. I even thought that even after the Costa Rica game, just because the way Costa Rica didn't play wasn't really all that challenging, and all had to do with, you know, the new coach and all those things. And they don't even do that well in Gold Cups anyways. But after this game, Peter, after this game against Mexico, now it is a legitimate question whether Max Crepeau is his job to lose for the number one. Because before it was like, okay, great, now we have another number one, another number two who can, you know, step in against a Panama, El Salvador, and give Borjan the much-needed rest, and Borjan can take the other two important games. But now it's like, wow, I mean, that save on Salcedo was not only incredible, but the first two saves in the first half, and then the other saves that he made, in the second half, late in the second half as well, to keep Canada in it,
huge,
were incredible. And honestly, think that Thursday night, Crapo played like a player that does not belong to be in the MLS. And I say that in the most honest regard. I know I have tons of people messaging me and saying that I rate Crapo way too much. And look, I've been rating Crapo for a while now. I think after his MLS campaign of being the best goalkeeper, it also helps when you're on the worst team in the MLS and you're sure. and you're saving 5-6 shots a game. But those kind of situations prepare you for this because you're playing against a heavy side Mexico mm-hmm. team, where the expectation was for Mexico to be powering through, and in certain parts they did, and Crapo was there to show up his face and deliver for Canada.
I agree with everything you said. I have always preferred Crapo over Borjan just because I think he's more well-rounded. You even saw in moments yesterday when Crapo could have played a shorter pass while Mexican players were, you know, pressed a little high. He opted to punt it forward. And when he saw the opportunity to play the short pass instead of punting it forward, he took it. Whereas I feel Milan Borjan on the ball is not at all comfortable in those situations. And that's when he is prone to those errors. The one area that you probably say he's lacking in right now, and it's not his fault, is just the experience and the caps, right? And this is why I still feel like Borjan will still be preferred, because John Herdman does favor leadership and guys in that leadership group, quote unquote, and Borjan is part of that. So I don't think he's going to drop Borjan for September. Like, I think if he's available and ready to come in, he'll be the starter. But Crapo's now made it a real conversation, whereas I feel like up before the Gold Cup, it was something like, yeah, it could happen, but I don't think the chances are very high. Now you're like, you know what? If he continues to play like this, and whenever he gets called upon for the national team and continues to perform, now you have a real dilemma on your hands. So that's really, I think, where it does stand at the moment.
And Crapo's not young. He's 27, too.
It's also true, yes. Couple more points on the match itself here. David Anthony at @A_Miller16 also Will Dunn asked what we thought about the late stoppage affecting the game, obviously with the homophobic chant that Mexican fans, mainly in the U.S., continue to chant. That obviously led to the extra stoppage time, which theoretically gave Mexico the chance to be able to win the match late. And they're basically asking, how much did that late stoppage affect the game? And should Mexico be punished more harshly for this? Maybe focusing on what happened in the match itself. Do you think it had any influence on the ending?
Yes, it did. We got conca-f***ed. That's just the reality. It's true, Peter. It's true. If it wasn't for those 9 minutes of stoppage time, which absolutely killed the momentum, it benefited Mexico in a big way. And look, we're in 2021. Mexican fans need to grow up. Like, seriously, like you can't be chanting these things. You have to adapt to the reality. And it's incredibly frustrating how, you know, the stoppage time benefited Mexico, while in hence, you know, it should have penalized Mexico. In what way? I don't know. I don't know what way CONCACAF could have maybe, you know, kind of penalized, because it was the fans, it was not the players. But it's terrible. Not only what happened in the stadium, but also you could see the frustration on the players' faces, on Mexican players' faces.
Yeah.
I feel like that also made the Canadian players and Mexican players fight even more. I mean, tensions were already heated before, but
yes.
I think that even gotten even more. And what I love about this Canadian, first of all, I forgot to mention this, but I love how Buchanan just shushed 72,000 Mexican fans.
Yeah, hilarious.
That was incredible. But I have to say, I didn't expect this Canadian team to be as fierce as they were. Like they decided not to be bullied around, and I want to know this question, but I'll probably never get the answer to how on earth were they communicating? Because the only one that speaks Spanish there is Jonathan Osorio and Piet, but he's on the bench.
Mm.
I know Crapo is married to a Chilean wife, but even then, I mean, I don't know how Spanish is, but I mean, I thought that was funny. But on the hindsight, yeah, we were concaft.
So some of those guys do speak English, in fairness, just having played abroad for so long. But yeah, I do find it funny. Like, you know, they were clearly having very long, heated conversations, which kind of goes to show you, no matter what language you speak, when you're angry, everything comes out, right? look, I maybe have a slightly different mind than you. I think Jonathan Osorio himself mentioned this after the game. And look, it's a very political answer, but I also think it's a very level-headed answer, too. He basically said that, look, both teams had to deal with it. They both benefited from the rest, and Mexico made a brilliant play for the goal. And I agree with them. Like, that pass from Pizarro for Herrera was terrific. Like, there's really nothing Canada could have done to stop that because they maintained a high enough line in that situation. Maybe you say to someone, try to close down Herrera when they see him running in. Sure, but that's such a split-second decision. And who would have thought that pass gets through? Mexico also had a couple of really good chances to score before that, but Crepo made the necessary saves, and or Funes Mori just happened to miss wide. So I don't think it had too much of an impact, but yeah, the fact this keeps happening, man, and look, CONCACAF is not going to do anything. FIFA isn't going to do anything. Like, they've already deferred the behind closed doors ban to the women's team, which is just so disrespectful. And then to top it off too, you have Mexico fans and Tayshaun Buchanan's Instagram comments just spouting racist bullshit, forcing him to have to shut down Instagram comments. Like, come on. I can't have this conversation any longer, otherwise I'll get really, really mad. And I will use up my cursing allotment, Thomas, and I don't want to do that. Let's move on to some more bigger picture things. Alex Trudeau at @Trude66 asked, really glad Theo Corbenu got some playing time against Mexico. He looked really dangerous at times, so do you think he got enough playing time at the Gold Cup to justify taking him out of Wolves preseason? What do you think about Corbenu's Gold Cup, and then also the fact that he did actually skip preseason for this? Most of it, anyway.
Yeah, I thought it was a certain decision. And, you know, he played, he scored against Martinique in the dying moments from a Cavallini pass. Other than that, you know, he didn't really feature a whole lot in the group stage. But, you know, he featured now against Mexico, and he featured against Costa Rica as well. And both of those games, he looked dangerous. So I think that was really, really good experience for him, considering that how good these two teams are. And look, what a shot that was. You know, Talavera got a hand on it, and that was incredible, considering this guy only has 90 minutes of first-team football in him. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Pardon me, less than 90 minutes, having been only featuring for the U23 side. So I think that was incredible. But, yeah, I do think that was the right decision because he sort of needed more exposure in a way. Now he goes back to Wolves. And I'd be surprised if his Wolves head coach, who replacing Nuno, didn't watch that game or didn't watch parts of that game or at least didn't hear about it.
Right.
So I think he will be given even more opportunities or will be sent out on loan. But that was an incredible shot, I have to say.
Terrific, yeah. And you figure that as the game went on and as Mexico's defenders got tired, his speed would have really caused them problems, and it did. And kudos to him for taking advantage of all of his appearances off the bench. Look, I still felt like he probably should have gone to preseason just because he is a young player. You have a new coach in there, and Wolves is also looking to offload attackers, so you maybe think there's a chance there. But that said, his cameos were very, very impactful, and that will help his confidence, I feel, just as much as if he was playing in preseason and impressing. And maybe now, because he did this against marquee opponents, Bruno Lage looks at this and thinks, okay, kid, maybe I'll give you a shot here to start the season and see what you can do with that. So it is twofold. But, you know, kudos to Corbenu for taking advantage of his opportunities, which were a bit more few and far between than maybe he would have liked. Now, some of those bigger picture questions as we look ahead to the Ocho itself. Josh Steffen, Dan Clark, FCP 1992, and CanMNT Focus, they want to essentially know, after what we saw against Mexico, given all the caveats and all the factors that were in play, does this suggest that Canada will be able to take points on the road against lesser Central American teams? Has Canada solidified itself as a top three or four team in the region? What do you say to all this, Thomas? I know it's quite loaded, but basically, what do you think is the outlook here, having seen how Canada performed at the Gold Cup?
Yeah, so it's like four or five questions punch into one. I'll do my best to answer them. So, for example, CanMNT Focus wants to know, is there a difference with this team compared to before? And there is. And the reason, one clear example, in 2019, Canada lost 3-1 to Mexico in the group stage in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah.
Canada managed this game so much more. Canada stayed in it for a lot longer. Canada actually scored in the second half after going down 1-1, something we didn't see there before. And look, Canada really didn't let the crowd affect them or the refereeing affect them. Maybe in that 2019 game, yes, they did let them affect that. And they just weren't as experienced and as familiar. And considering that 2019 had a lot less faces than we had, there was no Christian Buchanan, there was no Oscar Johnson, there was no... I mean, there was Kamal Miller, but he was just starting. So, you know, he was on the bench sort of thing. Mashupoe was in there, was Borjan. So, look, it was, you know, there is a huge improvement there. That's question number one. Question number two from Sandoval. You know, the question about the fans at home. Yes, I mean, 100%. Herman has said this many, many times. The number one goal is to win over the Canadian fans. And I feel like this kind of performance puts not only a dent on the entire region and puts the entire region on notice, hey, we're Canada, where would we play? We're good. But also puts the Canadian fans in notice that, hey, listen, if we play in Vancouver, have 50,000 come out and support us. In Edmonton, 30,000. I doubt Edmonton would get games because of their distance and obviously weather factor, but I do think that. And to finally off the question between Josh and Dan, Central America, I mean, look, if you can play 72,000 in front of 72,000 Mexican fans, I feel like you can do it in front of 30,000 Costa Rican fans, 25,000 Panamanian fans. And I understand that it was neutral venue and it was the U.S. and the facilities are good for
both
teams.
You're indoors, too.
And travel was closer as well.
Right.
I was supposed to Canada, traveling to San Jose and whatnot. But I do think it is not the full extent of the puzzle, but it is important. I mean, you have to count it in for sure.
I'm still on the fence, though, because you honestly can't know until it happens, and that's such a cop-out, but there are just so many factors. Like, yes, the fact that you're able to do it in front of 72,000 fans that are against you, and you're playing against a quality opponent, and you had a short turnaround between the Costa Rica and Mexico games, shows that you can probably do it, but you're also indoors in a mild climate. You know, that isn't your third game in 9 days, which is what Canada's going to have to deal with. So we really won't know until it actually happens. But what we can say is that on paper, they have shown that they probably are one of the best teams in the region and are showing it game by game on the pitch as well without some of those key players. And they have clearly locked in like we've never seen before. So if that continues in the Ocho, amid their domestic seasons, playing three qualifiers in 8 to 9 day spans, then they can definitely do it. They have the capability, but obviously it's easier said than done at this point. Moving over to a question from Jay Fitzsimmons, as well as Eddie Eng, who want to know, what is your depth chart ranking of the Canadian center backs right now? Kamal Miller is so good, and Daniil Henry remains over-aggressive, but good. Jay says that his would be Miller, Vitoria, Kennedy, Henry, he guesses, and then maybe Cornelius or Ferreira. He doesn't really know after that. So, Thomas, maybe if you were to make a top five, like, who would be in that pecking order for you right now?
Look, for me, it's only five names, and it's Miller, Kennedy, Henry, Vitoria, and Sterling. Those are the only ones that are playing. Cornelius is not playing, even though he just signed a new loan agreement to the top division of Greece. We'll see how much time he plays. Mandragor James just featured only 8 minutes with his new team, Beja, in the Danish Superliga. So it looks like from that sample size, looks like he's in it for another season of warming the bench. And Ferrer is unattached, so that's my top five. And if you want specific orders, it would go Miller, then Kennedy, then Vitoria, then Henry, then Sterling. And then everything else to me is, it's not that it's not relevant, it's just they're not playing. It's just simple as that.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, you maybe even throw Joel Waterman into the conversation just because he is getting more minutes with Montreal now, but even he would probably be fourth, fifth right now in the pecking order. Like, he wouldn't be your reliable starter like a Miller, a Kennedy, a Vitoria. I mean, Alistair Johnson's probably the second or third best center back, and he's not really a center back. So that just kind of goes to show you the state.
Actually,
right
now that you bring it up, I mean, if I'm Herdman, and I don't know, I have Vitoria who's injured, or Henry who can't come into camp. Just because, you know, you show that Sterling isn't a reliable option. I mean, because if he was, he would play him, right?
Right.
If you slide Johnston in as a right center back, and then you call up CBG to play right after Larea, you could have an option there.
You could. Eddie Eng's question is a little bit different, but he asks, would a center back pairing of Miller and Kennedy work well Thomas, I like what you said last week, or I guess a few days ago now, because that podcast literally just got released 2-3 days ago. But it's better to have Miller and Kennedy rotating as the left-sided center back when you have the short turnaround between games, because they're both of pretty similar quality. They offer you fairly similar attributes. It would just be the wise way to go. Theoretically, they could play together because Kennedy has experience playing on the right, but I'm not a fan of putting players on their weak quote-unquote side, which is obviously, you know, where Kennedy would be playing on the right. He's left-footed. That's a little bit awkward. I feel like if you were to go to a two, right now the best partnership might be Miller and Vitória because they have the recent chemistry together.
Yeah, that's fair. I think Miller and Vitória give you something different, but a partnership like Kennedy-Vitória or Kennedy-Henry or Miller-Henry as well, that works as well. I just see it in a way that you need a younger center back and a more experienced center back. Like I feel like we need too young, too old. I feel like you kind of expose yourself on two sides because both center backs give you something different. Both sets of center backs give you something different. So for me, it would, like you say, I wouldn't put Kennedy or Henry together just because they are young, and look, they play in the same position. So you're pushing one to play in out of position, and it would just be unorthodox.
It would be, yes. Mercury and Avery Yoon want to ask us a couple of tactical questions. So Mercury asked us, are we good enough now with everyone available that we should drop the third center back and play more on the front foot against the U.S. and Mexico in qualifying? What do you think about this proposition?
Yeah, I've been saying this for a while now. I do want to play. I don't want to play 3-3 at the back against Mexico and the U.S.
I'm very conflicted on this because if Canada were to play with a four, and they did against Costa Rica and Mexico and at times against the U.S., they defend in a three anyways. So it's all fluid. And you're seeing with Canada right now, they're playing basically positionless soccer. Guys will just fit into different roles in different situations. So for me, also because we literally just talked about how maybe outside of two or three center backs who you know are going to be reliable, there's really nobody else. And that's why playing the three at the back, or at least having the personnel to play three at the back in some situations, is the way to go right now. Because look at their defensive record in the last three games. Like, that was a major concern, was the defensive side coming into the Gold Cup. And now you can say it's at a level where you're feeling fairly confident with it. Yes, there are some very sketchy moments still, but they're fewer and far between compared to before the tournament started. So that's why I would be a proponent of still keeping, at least at times, the ability to have three defenders at the back at all times, just to protect yourself defensively. Now, Avery Yoon asked us, after World Cup qualifying and Gold Cup against the full range of opponent quality, are we now fully married to the 3-5-2? I don't think they are, per se. Like, I still think they're very tactically fluid, but it's certainly in the arsenal right now.
Yeah, it seems like we are. I mean, in a way, not fully, but it seems like that seems to be Herman's preferral tactical formation going forward. You know, it just seems like a very effective formation, whether you like it or you don't like it. But it seems every time you see it repeated, it seems like they're trying to perfect the system. And look, they have to a certain point because they've included extra training sessions. I'm sure they've done some video work. I mean, if they haven't, then I don't know what John Herdman's wearing a earpiece for during the games. But yeah, no, I think they have. However, I keep saying this. I just want to see Davies, David, and Laren play in a front trio for the first time in who knows how long, because I know that the midfield and the defense is good enough. And then you could put maybe Buchanan ahead of Adekube as a left back. I think that could happen too. Or even Johnston, who could play as a center back, and you have Larray as well. So you have different options, but I mean, I still think that Canada needs to be very multi-formational, because with the 3-5-2, I mean, it's not going to work against every single team in every single occasion.
No, of course. And no formation is going to be perfect against every single team in every single situation. And that's why we have seen them be so fluid tactically in the last three games. And it's good to have that. And to have the personnel to quickly rotate between formations is key. And you can still have that Laren, David, Davies front three and still have ample protection defensively playing in a 3-4-1-2 in possession. We saw it in March when all those guys were available. So it's very, very doable. And I think it could work against the bigger teams, as we saw, because inject a little more attacking quality in that Mexico game, and we might be talking about a different result. Who knows? Moving over to some of our surprises and or the guys who bolstered their stock the most ahead of World Cup qualifying, Thomas. Vincenzo Comiso asked, who's the player that surprised you the most for Canada? For me, it's Kamal Miller. Shane Wagenaar asked, who raised their stock for World Cup qualifying most with their Gold Cup performance? I agree with Vincenzo. You guys know that I have been waxing poetic about Kamal Miller all tournament. Thomas, who would it be for you?
The thing is, surprise player for me would be someone who wasn't a lock in the starting 11. And by that definition, it would have to be Crapo or Buchanan. But it's close. The problem is, if I give it to Buchanan, then it's not like he's a lock right now. Like right now, you have Davies, David, Hoylett, Cavallini. So it's difficult for him to get in the starting 11. Now, I think if as a left back, it's 100% certain. I think if you put him as a left back, he for me right now, he is more than Adekube. So I think I would have to say Buchanan, but not as a forward. Buchanan as a left back, that would be my answer. But Crapo's a close one. I think Crapo has bolstered stock a lot, and I think if he's almost there, or he's there as far as taking the number one spot from Milan Borja.
Now, Thomas, obviously results like this can have a lot of impact. So Will Dunn asked, does the chance of Flores playing for Canada go up after this performance last night? You tweeted about this. Like, how could Flores and his father watch this and not think, oh, wow, like committing to Canada probably would be a pretty good idea right now?
Yeah, I literally tweeted, if Flores doesn't come in now after watching this game with his father, then I don't know what will make him switch.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. I mean, this is as good as it gets. And, you know, it's not like he's watching the game and he's like, oh, well, I'm watching the game, but I'm not going to play against these type of opponents. What are you talking about? We just saw Corbin who played 15 minutes.
Exactly.
And he's only, what, 2 years older than Flores? And Corbin who has played two more years in the U23 league, and then Flores is being promoted to the U23 Premier League this year. So in a way, it's the exact same parallel in the sense it's the exact same environment. And just two years age difference, and they were going to play in the exact same league. Mm-hmm. So especially how big of an influence Flores' father has on Marcelo.
Right.
Because, you know, he wants him to play for Mexico. He wants to play for Mexico. But, he wanted to see him. I have a feeling that they wanted to take this Gold Cup to really analyze the option and, of course, focus on Arsenal preseason, which, you know, is an assertive decision. If this doesn't convince you, then I don't know what will. And same goes for Lucas Diaz. Same goes for Daniel Jevison. Same goes for everyone.
I agree. I 100% agree. And that's why at Ringio2018 asked, any chance of new commitments for September qualifiers? I feel like Jevison's probably the guy who has the best chance, but does he make that decision this early, not just, you know, in the qualifying cycle, but also early in the championship season where he's going to be trying to fight for a place at Sheffield United?
I think there is a good chance we see Jevison. But the thing is, if Tom Hartman, do you take Jevison over Miller? Yes, obviously for the reason that you would captain him and bring him into the program and introduce him and all that. But, you know, Miller's still getting used to his club as well, too. I mean, he's just moved over to Basel. So, you know, as far as how many changes you'd make, personally, I'd make 9 changes to this 23-man squad that just went to the Gold Cup, which really ended up being a 60-man squad with the suspensions, the injuries, and all that. Like people talk about depth, and don't get me wrong, we had depth in this tournament, we really did. But I mean, as the games went on, it seems like our bench got thinner and thinner and thinner, and the only names on the bench that you could really say, okay, this guy could be in the 11, for me were Piet, and that's it. Sterling didn't have it. Corbinu, Pasher, those were more filler in names. So, and Fraser, who looked pretty damn good in that game. So I would say, back to the question, yes, I do see it, but also other things to consider as well, because obviously other guys such as Miller are still adjusting to their clubs.
But it's a great problem to have, is it not? Especially as they will be playing 3 games basically in every single window. Marco Negri asked, great performance from Junior Hoylett throughout. What are the odds of him playing in another league other than Europe, say Asian football? I mean, Asia would be a bit of a stretch, but look, he has MLS offers. We know this. Like, I think it's been heavily reported. The question is, does he reunite with Neil Warnock, or does he come back home and play, well, whether it's in Toronto or in North America, in Major League Soccer?
Yeah, I agree with you, Peter. I think Asian football is a stretch unless the money for him was there.
Yeah.
I think the best thing right now to come home to the MLS, potentially with Toronto FC. And I know it's a struggling side right now, Toronto FC, but, you know, he said this countless times that he, you know, has dreamed of playing for Toronto FC. And, hey, now is the chance. He's unattached. The club are looking maybe for an attacking option besides after Akinola went down. So now is it seems like the perfect move in terms of filling in a replacement for Akinola. Hoylett is unattached. So it seems like you, for some things like this, Peter, you have to, the plan is have to align. And it is like the perfect. But again, I mean, Neil Warnock, he has experience with him, especially at Cardiff and QPR. Like, it's rarely ever you see a coach that you have experience with him in two different clubs. So they've worked with him for 3-4 years. So Middlesbrough would be good too. So I think those would be, for me, those would be the two other options. Any other clubs, any other MLS clubs, any other championship clubs, then you'd be sort of going out of the familiarity circle.
And one final question on the men's national team portion. Jesse at Jesse_JM asked, any update on Ricardo Ferreira finding a new club? As far as I've seen, nothing yet. And considering he's, what, 28, 29, has had some very major injuries and looks like a very worn down defender in his late 20s at an age where they tend to peak. You know, it's not looking too promising right now that he's going to find another club.
It's over. It's over for I'd love to be proven wrong, but no, it's over. And look, Peter, before we move on to the women's section and we talk about news and notes, I do want to kind of do a conclusion here. It would be better if there was a third place game at this Gold Cup and we could face Qatar, you know, the Asian champions. But, you know, it is what it is. You know, those things, situations are out of your control. Overall, I feel pretty good. I feel pretty good about September and the Ocho. I think Canada has demonstrated that they are in it for a World Cup, and they have the team to qualify for the World Cup. And I don't know. I mean, some people say that the Gold Cup isn't a tournament where you send your B players, you keep your best players at home. But in a way, we learned a lot from this Gold Cup, like a lot.
Yes.
We learned that Klopo can be a number one. We learned that Buchanan is an option as well. We learned that Ostakio is now a lock. He was a lock before, but even more so now.
Mm-hmm.
So we've learned so much more, and really props to Herdman. And what I love to see, and I'm going to end it with this quote. Herdman said in the presser, we've never been as close to a group of men as this. So it seems like this was a unifying moment, even in the defeats.
Exactly.
You lose a game like this and you still unify. And I feel like when you have guys that are as pissed off to lose a game like this, as Richie Lara said, or Richie Lai, excuse me, you see that this team is very competitive and they're united, which, you know, wouldn't happen. And maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Canada would let in a goal and instead of supporting each other, they'd be yelling at each other on the field. And you didn't see that at all this tournament. So, yeah, a lot of promise, and I'm super excited for the Ocho. To the game that happened in the dawn hours of Friday morning, where Canada tied 0-0 against Brazil, but won 4-3 on penalty kicks. It was just a few hours after Canada's loss. Fun fact, no goals in the last 200 minutes between these two teams. That sets up a meeting with the U.S. in a rematch of the 2012 semis after they bested Holland in a shootout after a 2-2 draw. Peter, I want to ask you what your thoughts were on Canada's performance against Brazil.
Well, I was a little bit pessimistic about their chances coming into it. So the fact that they went out there, closed it down, and really showed a very strong defensive performance, I feel like for the first time at the Olympics, they weren't under duress too much. Stephanie Labbe, like this was her game once again. And this isn't the first time she's done this at the Olympics, and she had to come up big, both in the game and in the shootout. That's exactly what happened. But I also thought that Alicia Chapman was terrific. Ashley Lawrence is always very, very solid. And they needed to be. It was a gutsy effort, and that's what was needed, because I worried about their ability to play more open and expansive against Brazil. And they showed that quote-unquote old-school mentality where they can still lock it down and get a result. And that kind of bodes well going into the semifinals, because I feel like there is an opportunity there for Canada to maybe upset the U.S.
And speaking about that game, Canada, it's an interesting one, Peter, because there is so much rivalry between the U.S. and Canada. Personally, I thought that, yes, Canada won in the penalty kicks. But, I mean, it's not the same way for me to win, to make it to a semifinal, to put yourself in a medal position, than, let's say, to win it in penalty kicks after 0-0. Do you feel that this Canadian team has any real chances of beating the U.S., considering how big the U.S. has been, and considering maybe how maybe the gap has widened between Canada and the U.S.?
Well, I think they have a chance, because if you look at specifically the U.S. defense, it's been very shaky, and they've been vulnerable defensively for most of the tournament. So you feel like there's a chance there. Defensively, Canada has welcomed too much pressure in games previous to this one, and it hurt them, because they probably could have won those matches if they were a little more clinical and maybe didn't play so deep in their own defensive third. So they need to be careful with that. If they are, then the chance is definitely there. And given how motivated these players get to play the U.S., yes, the overall record against them is not great. I think they've lost 50 games overall in their history. But they have played them very competitively, and they have, especially in games on this kind of a stage, that they can give them problems. So there is a chance. There always is. It just matters how they kind of approach it in certain situations, much like with the men's team against some of those marquee opponents. All right, and switching to news and notes to close out the show, there were a couple of transfer rumors and pieces of news to go through. We'll start with Kyle Larin, who recently rejected Besiktas's 3-year contract offer that would have paid him about 2 million euros annually. His current deal expires in June 2022, and as a result, the club have lowered their asking price from 15 million euros to 10 million euros. So, Thomas, given that he does risk leaving on a free transfer next summer, do you think that he ends up getting sold before the closing of this window?
I'm going to say no, because if it hasn't happened at this point, what are the chances that it happens last minute? And honestly, like, are you really going to pay $10 million for a player that only has one year in his deal? You've seen it before. You pay it, but then you extend his contract before you pay it. Like, it's sort of like it's a buy and extension, right? But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we knew that this was going to be the summer for Kyle Larin to, you know, I've only seen Premier League teams. Really, I haven't seen any other leagues as far as Premier League, but not just Larin, but Eustáquio was supposed to go to Porto. That didn't materialize itself. Now, what did materialize itself was Adekube and other players as well. Miller going to Switzerland with Basel. So there was a couple of transfers, but, you know, disappointed that, you know, not only Larin, but Eustáquio's transfer hasn't happened as well.
Indeed. The one risk you face when you run down a deal and you let the club know ahead of time, you can get dropped just like that. I don't think that'll happen with Larin per se, because they are in a very bad financial state right now, Besiktas, even with the Champions League. So they either have to sell him or keep him. Otherwise, they might not be able to afford a replacement if they decide, all right, we're not playing you for the rest of your time here. Will they be able to afford someone, you know, who costs around the same price and pay those wages? I don't know. It might be best for both parties to sell him now, because Larin does want to go, but I feel like he does have the leverage in this situation, just because if he does go, he gets his desired move. If he stays, then he plays in the Champions League, gets himself in the shop window, and then gets a move and a bit more flexibility to earn that move, obviously being available on a free transfer, and also more wages, which is nice for him. Moving over to Tejon Buchanan, because Augsburg are now seen as one of the front runners for him, according to Transfer Market. New England, as mentioned, already turned down a bid from Lens in France. Club Bruges is also interested in him. Now, the Revolution would prefer a deal that keeps Buchanan in New England until the end of the season before shipping him off in January. So what do you think ends up happening here with this?
I think you have to try and make both parties happy. I think it would make more sense for Buchanan to end the season, you know, end the MLS season and join his European club in January, rather than leave now that the summer is just about to come to an end. I think there was a question earlier about how much Buchanan is worth. Yes. And I think that would have to be somewhere around the 5-6 million, even as much as 7 million. I mean, you could make the argument, right? Mm-hmm. That maybe on the higher end, but you know, Augsburg looks like the right club for him. You know, he's proved it enough at the MLS level. It's not like he's had a amazing season such as maybe Carlos Vela type numbers. Right. But you know, he also isn't a center forward, right? So obviously his goal scoring record is not going to be amazing. But he has shown enough over these couple of seasons, and I think Bundesliga is the right location for him. I think the Premier League would be much too challenging.
I agree with that, yes. I think the Bundesliga could be the best place for him to thrive. A trade in MLS involving a Canadian occurred prior to the Mexico game. Marc-Anthony Kay was traded to the Colorado Rapids from LAFC in exchange for about $1 million in allocation money and a first-round pick. Came as a bit of a surprise, Thomas, but given that LAFC want to bolster their attack and needed to free up the funds, Kay is obviously a hot commodity right now. It makes a lot of sense, and he's joining a Colorado team that has quite a loaded midfield. So what do you make of the move overall?
I mean, look, he's leaving a good LA team that's, you know, kind of on the back end right now, and joining a Colorado team that is, you know, it's a bit more higher, but I don't know. I'm sort of indifferent about this move. I'm not in one way or another happy or sad about it. I think it's just it's a bilateral move for me. It's one of those moves that it's within league. It's, you know, it's will that impact how Kai plays for the national team? I don't think so. Will that impact his club career? Perhaps. You never know. But LAFC is the only club that he's known in the MLS. So, you know, this change comes maybe at the right time, because I you know, there was maybe some rumors. I don't know if they're true or not, but there was some rumors that, you know, perhaps, you know, they were kind of looking to deal him. I mean, they did pull the trigger, so they must have been true. So I don't know. I think Kai has more to show, but it could be one of those Lucas Cavallini opportunities.
Possibly. And we know that he wants to go to Europe with his deal expiring soon. You feel like the window is now or never. So we'll have to see what happens over the next 6 months and see if Kay ends up getting that desired move overseas. One final note, 22-year-old forward Deanne Rose is off to Reading in England after the Tokyo Olympics finish. So we'll see another Canadian woman abroad, which is fantastic to see. She was incredible at Florida and is one of many young attacking stars for Canada, and you can only imagine playing at a higher level will only help her, and it's good that she got that move secured now before the Olympics are done. That is going to do it for us this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this impromptu special edition of the show. We will speak to you in a few days.